And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70 celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined on Zoom by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton, who is zooming in from Los Angeles, which is exciting.
I think it's technically Pasadena. I'm not sure.
Oh.
Los Angeles is very large, and it has a lot of different neighborhoods. And I am never sure what is actually a Los Angeles neighborhood and what is its own distinct geographic entity. So, Southern California. I am zooming from Southern California.
Pasadena, I remember always being a favorite of like the Marriott set which is most baseball writers. But I've never actually been to Pasadena.
You know, the reason I stay here is because the first time I came out to LA, which was in 2010, the year after I graduated from college, we came out here. One of my friends from college lived out here, then still lives out here. I'm actually going to get lunch with him in a brief period of time. And we drove around, like he lived in, I think, Burbank at the time. And we drove around Pasadena and we saw the Rose Bowl, and it was a very nice day out. And I really liked the area, and I have stayed in Pasadena every trip since. And I have not been back to the Rose Bowl, so it's like 4 minutes away from where I'm staying. Maybe I'll actually go and visit it sometime this weekend.
Like pay homage to the large stadium. I can't say that it's not worth it because, again, I've never been to Pasadena.
Pay homage, obviously, to the Giants' victory in Super Bowl 21 over the Broncos and Phil Simms' remarkable performance that day.
How is being back on the road as a beat writer? Because I know, you know, this it's not your first trip of the year. It's your first West Coast trip, obviously. And I know there are still some restrictions in place. You're not in the clubhouse every morning. But how has it been? Like, is it strange? Do you feel like an insider again? Or is it still like a sort of a balancing act?
It's better. It's still not what you want it to be as a reporter. You know, it's one of the frustrating things of the last 2 years has been it's really difficult to do a story with like several perspectives from players, right? It's hard to, you know, if I wanted to do a story on an individual player, what he's doing, how he's playing or something, a lot of times you can do that in a day or two in the clubhouse because you can get that player, you can get a coach, you can get the manager, you can get like two other players talking about how important it is that he's playing this way or something like that. And, you know, the last couple of years, it's been basically like you can get that player and the manager, and that's it. And that's not, and everyone else is privy to those conversations, so they can write the same thing. So it's been nice over the last couple months to get a little bit more of being able to have a couple different voices in the story, or to have players react to things that are being said more publicly, whether in Zoom or, you know, via Twitter. Like it was helpful on Wednesday that, you know, Steve Cohen has that tweet and we are able to talk to Hugh Quattlebaum, the hitting coach, that morning in San Francisco on the field and get his reaction. And, you know, since then I've been able to talk to some players about that, you know, myself on the field. You still can't do like the larger stories that you want to do in a short period of time. Like there's a story I'm working on that I might write within the next week with a couple different player voices in it. And I've talked to players about it over the course of like the last month, you know, and I've gotten like four interviews done over like 3 or 4 weeks on it. And it's still like it's difficult to get everyone you want. The Mets, you know, you can get players after batting practice generally. But the Mets haven't taken batting practice every game. You know, they don't take it during day games. They don't take it on days where they have doubleheaders. They don't take it on days after doubleheaders or tough travel days. So it's, you know, they probably take batting practice about half the time. So you don't always, you know, the pitchers are always out there. The relief pitchers are always throwing. So you can get a relief pitcher any day you want, essentially. But it's harder to get hitters that you want. So, you know, I came into this road trip with like a single player that I really wanted to talk to. And we've played four games and I haven't had a chance to yet.
But some of those relievers seem pretty entertaining. Like I could go for like a daily Aaron Loop update.
I had a good conversation with Trevor May on Thursday that went for a while. So you know, those guys are often in a clubhouse. I think reporters probably compare relievers in baseball to like offensive linemen in football, in that they're like they seem to be the most laid back and affable mm-hmm. on the team. And you know, relievers have kind of. It sounds mean to say, but like less to do on a daily basis than a lot of the other players. You know, starters have their own like very strict 5-day routine. Relievers, it's like you go out, you play catch, you get loose at 4:30 or something for a 7 o'clock game, and then you've got some time to sit around if you want. So they generally are a little bit more accessible in any circumstances than the rest of the roster. But you know, there's only so many times you can go to a reliever for insight on, you know, the offensive woes of this team.
But the best quote on the team, almost invariably, is your backup catcher.
that is the old cliche. The backup
catcher. Is that a cliche? I found that actually true. It was like if you're like, you need someone to talk about a pitcher. Obviously, a pitcher. It felt like maybe even that teams are hiring backup catchers as like quasi coaches, and so they have an ability to speak about the game in a way that like you just don't necessarily see elsewhere in the clubhouse.
I know when I got into the industry, the first team that I covered in the clubhouse was the 2009 Mets. So that was, they had Brian Schneider, Omer Santos was. Became the primary catcher for a little while. And I remember, you know, mm-hmm. Marty Noble, who was working with MLB.com. I was his intern, essentially. You know, Schneider was pretty good to talk to after games. And Marty had said, you know, the most important thing in a clubhouse is a good catcher, because he can give you kind of the mood of the clubhouse. He can tell you what's going on with any pitcher on the staff, probably more candidly than the pitcher himself will tell you, or even the pitching coach. And is good on what's going on offensively. Like, he can cover everything. That's why catchers are good managers. In my experience covering teams since then, I haven't had a ton of really good catchers to talk to. You know, I've covered some younger catchers. That's a little tougher. They don't feel quite as comfortable breaking down a pitcher. I remember in Boston, Jared Saltalamacchi, who was a very nice guy, very polite, very easy to talk to, very accessible. Mm. But wasn't really critical of a pitcher. You know, a guy can go out there and give up 7 runs in 3 innings, and he'd say, you know, he's really throwing the ball well. really seemed like he should have had better results, which is sometimes true, but not as often as Jared seemed to suggest. So I think catchers can be really good players to talk to. They have like the highest ceiling of a player to talk to, but it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah, you missed the Mike Nickias to Anthony Recker transition among Mets backup catchers, which from a coverage standpoint was just always exceptional. Like, yeah. Those two guys would give you, they give you like a pointed anecdote in the form of a scene to answer your question, rather than just like not just an honest answer, but like a really detailed and like dumbed down for your level answer.
So here's how you should frame your story, they start. You
know, right. Like. Yeah. Anthony Recker could write your lead if you want. very handsomely. Nickias, too. That was the Mets were going for at that era. They were like, we need like a very smart, very handsome backup catcher.
If you don't play that much, that could be an important thing.
Might
to
as
have.
Well, yeah. It's eye candy is the new market inefficiency. when you travel, this is more of a personal question, but because the life of you are a hardworking person, and the life of a beat writer, especially in a more traditional year when you're traveling a ton, is an arduous one. I would have to guess based on how much travel there is. When you're in a place like L.A., do you make a point of eating L.A. food, or is it just like you eat out of convenience?
You try. It's and like I've been fortunate in I've never traveled like the full road schedule the way a lot of beat writers have to. You know, mm-hmm. I think the most road games I've covered in the season is like 55 out of 81.
That's still a lot. It's a lot of time to be on the road.
Still a bunch. You're on the road just about, you know, a week or two a month, 10 days a month, I think it's what it kind of averages out to. The first day in a city is always the hardest because you flew in that morning, and I find that I generally have to choose between whether to nap or to eat lunch. Like, I can't do both, and napping usually wins, and I have like a granola mm-hmm. bar for lunch. Monday in San Francisco, like I flew into San Francisco Monday morning, so I was up technically at like 1:30 in the morning San Francisco time that day to fly in. But fortunately, like because of the time difference, I was able to get a nap and have a small bite to eat for lunch. I did try there to have I had like some Korean takeout, mm-hmm. which I don't know if that is necessarily a San Francisco thing. I mean, like New York has all of these things too, but it was right next to the hotel too, so it was convenient and it was a little bit different than what I normally eat at home. I tried not, you know, I used to just eat like a hamburger everywhere I went. Now I try to have like a little bit more diversity in there. In LA, I'm actually meeting up with a couple different friends, so I'm letting them choose good restaurants here for me, so I don't have to do that whole thinking thing.
Yeah, I always found one thing I always liked about LA is the late night accessibility, like that you can find food, because a lot of places I think were spoiled as New Yorkers. A lot of places like you can't get food in Cleveland after a game, like not near where you're staying. There's one pizza place and they do delivery and that's it. If you want pizza from that place that you can eat, and if you don't, like, you hopefully you have granola bars. LA, there's like all of the ramen places are open. That I always found ramen was my move, especially I typically stayed anytime doing Dodgers postseason stuff, I would always stay in the downtown LA, which is right near Little Tokyo and filled with ramen options, which would be my recommendation. The point I was going to make was just that, like, if you're traveling and covering it and traveling not for vacation, obviously, but for work and dealing with the baseball schedule, which is long, a city's food culture becomes valuable, not necessarily for its like peaks, but I think for its like the breadth of availability, and also like, does this place, like you mentioned Korean takeout, like a city like San Francisco has like tons of good takeout options, and good takeout options becomes like the most valuable thing, because like, you're never going to sit down for a meal.
Yeah, and like I try to when I go to a city, like I try to do something cultural in that city. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like in San Francisco on Tuesday, I went for a very long walk, forgetting the hilliness. Did we talk about that on the last podcast? We might have.
I think we talked about it before it. I think via text message before.
That I had forgotten that, like, to get from where I was staying to Fisherman's Wharf in that area, I had to basically summit the city of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And it was just, like, nice to experience, like, 70-degree summer weather in San Francisco the way we have not had in New York all summer. And, you know, I try to find, like, good museums. I haven't been to a museum this year because the circumstances are different, but find good museums or bookstores. I went to a great bookstore in San Francisco, City Lights, and bought myself a couple of books. I try to do something that like, I wouldn't do on a Tuesday when I'm in my apartment in Queens before heading to a game, like, to get some better experience out of it. But I do find that I eat more on the road most of the time outside of the first day, and I eat less healthy. Like, I just, because you're eating, you know, you're not making yourself something nice with groceries at home for lunch. You're having a hamburger or Korean takeout after a game, which was delicious, but probably not the best for my body.
Yeah, I mean, and again, like, I never traveled enough that I had to, like, it would be like, okay, well, I'm gonna travel for the month of October, I'm just gonna eat like crap, like, I'm just resigned to that, and then the baseball season will be over and I can get back to the gym or whatever. But I find it admirable that you're trying to do cultural things while also trying to cover a New York Mets team that we haven't really discussed yet, and has played only one game since we last spoke on Wednesday. That game, and this may shock you, was a 4-1 loss in which the offense didn't really arrive.
Yeah, you know, this was the game in the series against the Dodgers that you might have felt good about going in. You were facing a bullpen game, and really, I think technically you would call it a second straight bullpen game against LA, although Mitch White threw, I think, 7 1/3 innings in the first bullpen game for the Dodgers, which I don't think counts as a bullpen game. It was the bullpen game, and then it was Walker Buehler, who is one of the like main contenders for the Cy Young in the National League this year, Max Scherzer, who I believe has won 3 Cy Youngs, and David Price, who has won 1 and been a serious contender for several others. So those were going to be the 3 toughest games, probably in the order it goes, Buehler, Scherzer, Price. And then you thought Thursday, coming off a really nice win Wednesday, you've got Taijuan Walker, who's pitched better the last few. He is your all-star starter and had taken a no-hitter into the 7th against this team last week. And he pitched, I think, you know, I don't think the line was a fair evaluation of Walker on Thursday. You just saw the way, like, the Dodgers took advantage of their relatively rare scoring opportunities against him in a way that the Mets just haven't. Like, they had that second and third no-out situation in the second inning, and they get back-to-back RBI groundouts, which, like, that's 0-for-2 with runners in scoring position in the box score. But that's still getting both runs in. You know, the Mets are a team that, like, when they've got a runner in scoring position, they get a hit and he doesn't score, it seems. So it's just the way they took advantage situationally of a couple different things. They get, you know, the 2 more runs in the, I think it was the 5th inning, when Billy McKinney gets the 2-out double and then he gets driven in by a two-out RBI double just to make it 3-1. Then he gets driven in by Trey Turner with a 2-out RBI single. You know, 2-out hits with runners in scoring position. Those are the things Walker has not given up as much this year and has been really good in those situations. So that was kind of a backbreaker at that point in the game. And then they just, you know, it's tough when you're facing a bullpen and you're facing a different pitcher each time up as an offense. But this wasn't like, you know, I know the Dodgers have pitchers who have done very well in the bullpen. This was not necessarily a murderer's row of their relievers. You didn't see Kenley Jansen in this game. You saw, you know, Evan Phillips for the longest period of time, a guy who I believe the Orioles cast off not too long ago. So it seemed like this was a game that the Mets could have taken advantage of offensively and built on what they did in the final innings on Wednesday. But instead, they faced 16 pitchers in the last 2 days. They've only scored runs against 3 of them.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You mentioned the pitchers for the Dodgers. The Mets will send Carlos Carrasco, Rich Hill, and then Stroman on Sunday. So I think you can feel optimistic about the Stroman-David Price matchup if you forget about the teams that they both play for otherwise. And it's baseball, so maybe the Mets take 2 out of 3. Maybe they sweep the rest of the series. You don't love where they're, I mean, we've talked about it at length. This is a hard, hard stretch of the season for them at a time when they were playing as poorly as they have at any point this year. Am I crazy to be looking at this? And I'm not throwing in the towel for the Mets. Like, a lot can change. A lot has changed with their position in the standings in the last 2 weeks. There's no way it can't flip around the other way. Am I wrong to have one eye on the offseason at this point?
I mean, I think fans, even in like positive circumstances, when the Mets were 4 up in the division but not playing their best ball, I think there was a segment of the fan base that had its eyes on the offseason. That's the most intriguing part of following baseball, is seeing what personnel changes the team's going to make, especially a team where we know as little as we do about the Mets, about how they're going to be run in the offseason, like we talked about last time. And they're at an intriguing point where they have this position player core of guys who were all really good, who were all, to varying degrees, good and above average in 2019 and 2020. You know, from Pete Alonso being awesome in 2019 and hitting 53 home runs, to Dominic Smith and Michael Conforto being like down ballot MVP candidates in 2020 and having OPSs over 900, to all of them in 2020 basically taking a step back. You know, Alonso has been all of them in 2021 taking a step back. Alonso has been good this season. Nimmo has been good this season, although he got hurt. JD Davis has been pretty good, although he got hurt. So I think one of the interesting things to look at with the Mets roster is like what those guys have done since the start of 2020, because they're, you know, considering some of the injuries, those guys are about at a season's worth of plate appearances now. It's been what they've played 181 games since the start of 2020, but you know, it's I just looked up like Dominic Smith, like since the start of 2020, is what is his OPS plus, right? Because it was so good last year and it's below average this year. And it's 111. You know, his OPS is 775. He's a 268, 329, 446 guy in 635 plate appearances. And that is like, that feels like the fairest evaluation of him over the last span than like the high of 2020 versus the low of this year. If you had said at the start of 2020, okay, over the next 180 games, Dom Smith's going to give you a 111 OPS plus, that would sound about right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Pete Alonso's at 124 in that span. Brandon Nimmo's at 129, although he's got only 484 plate appearances because of some injuries. You know, Conforto's at 119. That's below his career track record. So even though he had the great 2020, 2021's dragged that down. You know, Jeff McNeil's at 106, which is lower than it had been before. I think, you know, I wrote about him Thursday night into Friday morning and just how just doesn't look right offensively, and how what the Mets are trying to kind of tinker with his approach is a proxy for how they're trying to tinker with a lot of guys in ways that don't change fundamentally who they are as a hitter, but try to unlock something a little bit more in them, and how delicate that is to do with guys who've had success and not that long ago.
It sounds like when we talk about this year, because when I think about the offseason, which is what I was trying to get to, is like there's this, when you get so frustrated with a team, there's this instinct to say like, okay, no, this isn't going to work. Like this core of players is not championship caliber, and it's time to blow it all up. Like, see what you can get for Dom Smith, and see what you can get for Jeff McNeil, and maybe Alonso, and you know, give Conforto the qualifying offer, and if he walks, let him walk, and you know, like just move on. And I don't think that's the right approach, but I think that a big component of that is that they have a sizable investment left in Jacob deGrom. They have a giant investment in Francisco Lindor. They've got a decent sized investment in James McCann. Like they have money committed out, I mean, especially to Lindor, that it seems like you're not at a point where you're ready to do that. And then I wonder, is that foolish? Like, is it foolish to think that way when you can just cut the cord and start over?
Yeah, I mean, like, there have been people in the comments on my stories suggesting that the Mets tank and rebuild, and that would not, I don't see that as a viable option at all. I'm also, it's just also very strange to me how much fans want their team to do that in any given point in time.
Oh, I get it. How can you not, I'm sorry, you've been watching this team, how can you not understand the instinct to be like, just get rid of everybody?
I can understand the instinct, but I can't understand it to the people who want, like, let's just be terrible for 4 years, you know,
right?
Like, watch the Orioles.
Except that I don't think it's really the way to win anymore, because I think it's too well known.
Too many teams are doing it.
Yeah, but it did work, right? Like, it definitely worked for the Astros. It's not what the Dodgers went, how the Dodgers went around about becoming a dynasty, but. It was an effective method at one point.
Yeah, it worked for the Astros and it worked for the Cubs. If the Astros didn't cheat, we don't know if it works. If the Cubs lose one, you know, the Cubs were down 3-1 in the World Series mm-hmm. to a team that they weren't better than, that they shouldn't have been down to. They almost, you know, if they hadn't won that 2016 World Series, how would we feel about tanking? Like, you know, you look at, I think it's interesting in another sport, in the NBA, like the Oklahoma City Thunder had top five picks in three consecutive years and drafted three NBA MVPs and didn't win.
Right.
So it's, I know that's a different sport. That's actually one where it would seem easier to tank for just a couple of guys and rise up. You know, you've got to do a lot of things to make that process work. And certainly Houston and Chicago, when they went into their slumbers, they were in much worse situations talent-wise at the major league level, and even, I think, a bit at the minor league level than where the Mets are now. So I do not advocate the Mets tanking. I don't know how you could do that successfully. Too many of their players are making too much money or are too close to making money to bring back tons of minor league talent the way you would want to. I do think, you know, just rattling off like OPS pluses of guys over the last 2 years, one of the concerns you would have if you were the Mets are that two of the guys you have bigger investments in McCann and Lindor, have had below average offensive production now since the start of 2020. They're, you know, Lindor's at 97, McCann at 96, and, you know, the other guys we mentioned were all above 100. They're maybe less above 100 than you expected, but they were all above it. So the guys you are most invested in are the guys who have had the roughest offensive performance over the last 2 years, or whose bad 2021s have affected them the most. So
in, go on.
No, I said so with no idea of where I was going with that. So you came in at the right time.
In Lindor's case, it does sound like he may be able to improve his stats a little bit sooner than at least I expected. What's the latest on the injury situations here?
Yeah, so he was working out with Javi Baez on the middle infield on Thursday afternoon before the game, having a lot of fun with it. The hope is that I think Baez is eligible to come off the injured list on Sunday. Maybe he does come off that day, but should be back shortly after that, if not on Sunday, you know, for that series against the Giants that starts Tuesday. Lindor could be back. You know, he's gone through his 10 days. He's eligible to come off whenever. And he could be back, you know, as soon as probably that Tuesday against San Francisco. I'm not sure that they would. I'm not sure that he's ready for that just yet. He's taken swings, I think, right-handed twice off of live pitching and left-handed once. They probably want him to do that again a bit before he comes back. And they've still talked about the possibility of a rehab assignment actually for both guys. They haven't ruled it out for both guys. But
they're running out of runway there, though, right? Doesn't the minor league season end at, like, in a week and a half?
No, it goes a little deeper this year because it got the late start. So it goes into like mid-September, even September 20th.
That's convenient.
Which is also convenient when you think about Jacob deGrom needing some runway there. So, you know, like, you will have some time to see what this offense looks like with its healthy pieces back again, knock on wood. You know, those guys, we said that in early July, and then Lindor went out. You know, they had basically that one stretch against, I feel like it was really just the series in Cincinnati where the offense looked really good. And outside of that, it hasn't at any point this year.
But it looked really good in that series.
But you'll get,
that
you
was
know,
fun.
You hope to get 5.5 weeks of seeing what this lineup looks like with those guys in, and hopefully no one else gets hurt over that stretch, and see, you know, with, I don't know what the everyday lineup will look like, where McNeil fits in, if Baez and Lindor are your middle infield. Maybe get a sense for how those pieces fit together, if you want to think about re-signing Baez, or even if Baez is a stand-in in your mind for the returning Robinson Cano next year. That's a way to get the fan base riled, right? Like, let's hand the second base job to Robinson Cano in 2022. But just thinking about, like, you watch the Giants, you watch the Dodgers, and you see, like, not everyone is a regular everyday player. They don't have a set lineup of eight guys that they run out there every day. They've got strong benches. They're able to mix and match really well. They take advantage of each guy's strengths. The Mets wanted to do that this year. It's been harder for them to do it because guys haven't played to their strengths. Like, J.D. Davis is having a good year, but it's against right-handed pitching, not left-handed pitching. So, you know, you might say when Baez comes back, well, why don't you platoon McNeil and Davis? But, that you know, Davis has the reverse split. Same with Dominic Smith. You know, Kevin Pillar has not hit lefties really at all this year compared to what he'd done in previous years. So you can't kind of work him into the mix the way you might think otherwise. So that's part of it. But I do think, you know, a lot of times you think as a fan, like, well, okay, J.D. Davis is not going to be our regular third base. I don't want to be the regular third baseman next year. He doesn't have a defensive fit. Trade him. See what you can get. Trade him for a reliever. You know, everyone wants to trade guys for a reliever or a prospect. And I think it's fine to have JD Davis as your 10th player. Like, you know, a guy who comes off the bench, who starts against lefties, who starts 60 games instead of 130. And to have good players like that, he's cost controlled. He doesn't cost a ton of money to do that. That's valuable. You can think about, you know, Smith in the same way. It's going to be really one of the bigger issues the Mets are going to face in the offseason, the same one they faced last year. They're not going to know about a designated hitter all offseason long. That's going to be part of the new CBA. The new CBA is going to be a contentious issue the entire winter. So we're going to talk about, we don't know where the luxury tax threshold is going to be, and we don't know if there's going to be a designated hitter in the National League. And those are two issues that will affect the Mets more than most teams. So that's going to be a frustrating thing for them to deal with, and they're going to have to operate in kind of a cloud about those things, and that's going to change maybe how they, you know, that changed last year, how aggressively they went after someone like George Springer or some other center field options, and we'll see if they change their tune on that this winter facing the same circumstances.
We have a question via email from Adam. If you have a question, please do email askTedBerg@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter. I'm at OGTedBerg. Tim is at Tim Britton. Adam wants to know, this is a layup. It's not going to take us very long. Do you think, unless you have a hot take here that you're welcome to share, but he wants to know, do you think Gary Cohen and Howie Rose will join Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy as Frick Award recipients? We haven't always had great teams, but we have the best announcers.
I believe Gary Cohen has already been a finalist for the Frick Award, which is the Hall of Fame award honoring broadcasters. So I would think that he would be a pretty serious candidate for that moving forward. I know they cycle through like what era broadcasters they consider on a regular basis. So, you know, he was a candidate a couple years ago, and he wasn't the year after because they were talking about broadcasters earlier in the sport's history. I think Rose would probably also be a candidate down the road. I think probably because Cohen's gotten there first, he would get the shot first. I don't know if they've ever had a situation where like two of the three finalists were people who overlap calling games for the same team. I think they, you know, as in the BBWAA, we have a similar award for writers, and there is always the thought, like, you know, you're not going to get your market have a writer go in like consecutive years or something. You're gonna, you know, you aim to get one guy in, then you wait a couple of years, and then you aim to get another person in or something like that. So I don't know exactly how the Frick Award goes, but I would expect, it would surprise me at this point if Gary Cohen did not get in, and it would also surprise me if Howie Rose didn't become at least a serious candidate at one point. They're both so very good at what they do.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know when it would happen, but I have to assume if they stay in their jobs, it seems like longevity, and this is not to knock it, but longevity is a big part of it, because if you have a lot of longevity as a broadcaster, it means you're doing a really good job and you become like sort of a beloved part of the team's fan experience. Certainly seems like Gary Cohen and Howie Rose are that for Mets fans, and it certainly seems like they're not going anywhere. So I would expect that, you know, maybe not, maybe it's 20 years from now, but eventually they'll both be in.
Yeah, I mean, it has been such an enjoyable part of the experience growing up as a Mets fan to have, you know, Mets fans have had Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, Ron Darling on TV for the last 16 years. You've had Howie Rose on the radio for that stretch of time. And he's had, you know, he's cycled through a couple different partners, but they've generally been good. The radio has been a really good broadcast over that time. Mm-hmm. And even before that, you had Gary Thorne, who's been back this year a little bit. You had Tim McCarver, who I think really set the standard kind of for a player going into the booth and being able to handle play-by-play and analysis and being critical of the teams that he broadcast for. It's interesting to me, like, you know, when McCarver was reaching the end of his time at Fox, there was a lot of talk about, you know, fans never liked the national broadcasters, and people wanted Fox to move on from McCarver. And I think he's been really difficult to replace. I don't think they've been, you know, I think John Smoltz is pretty good, but has not been quite as good. I mean, Smoltz is good at the analysis.
John Smoltz is the guy who makes me yearn for Tim McCarver.
Yes. Yeah, Smoltz, I thought, was really good at the start. I think, you know, it's been tougher because the game has changed so much since, you know, he retired.
I don't care that, yeah.
He retired that long ago. He retired, what, in 08 or something? And the game is completely different than it was when he played, and he has not adapted to that. So when he was calling games,
well, it's not that it's... But it's not the lack of it's not the lack of adaptation that gets me. It's the apparent disdain for the fact that the game does change.
Yes. You know, so I thought when he was calling games in 2014 or so, before a lot of those changes had taken place, I thought it was pretty good. You know, right before Rajay Davis's home run off Aroldis Chapman, he was like, the only place he can get to the ball is down and in on a slider. That's where he's looking.
Yeah. Oh,
and
he knows his stuff.
Yeah. But you would like, you know, it was, I saw someone on Twitter contrast the way like the Olympic track and field was broadcast. You know, there was that one, I think it was the 400 meter hurdles where both guys broke the world record, and it was like one of the great Olympic races of all time. And the enthusiasm of the broadcasters watching that was so transparent, even to people who don't really know the sport that well, that you watch a baseball game, you just don't get that to the same extent on a national broadcast. And it's one thing that really, I think, hinders the sport moving forward. But so to go back to the original point, the Mets had Tim McCarver for a long time. They had Ralph Kiner. They had all of these great broadcasters going back to Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy and Ralph to start. So it's been one of the pleasures of being a Mets fan growing up and to cover the team even now when you throw the game on MLB TV or the radio to hear really good broadcasting night after night.
And that's to say nothing of the podcasts.
So many good podcasts. I don't listen to any of them. Not even this one. You know who can? But no.
There's a lot of content out there.
Yeah, it is. It is. You can have. There are so many different ways to follow this team in depth and to the level of depth that you want to. I'm always impressed by just how much. You know, I think fans today know so much more about the sport than I did growing up as a fan, than most people did not that long ago. So it always, you know, I see some of the level of analysis in comments that we have on our stories. You know, sometimes they are the trade everyone sucks variety, which is understandable. And then other times they're like, you know, relatively deep breakdowns of things going on with individual players or the team. And those are things that, like, I was not thinking of or the kind of analysis I was definitely not doing when watching the 99 Mets.
And it all just serves to make me more miserable. Tim, we will talk next week about how the Mets play these upcoming days in Los Angeles.
I'm going to go see the Rose Bowl. Adios.
Peace.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.